Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Headlines last week proclaimed the discovery of a massive black hole from close to the dawn of time, 12 billion times the mass of the sun. Besides sounding impressive, there's a puzzle there. How could something so enormous grow so quickly? Black holes could be the key to understanding how the universe became what it is today, shaping how galaxies form with blistering particle winds. This hour on Point in the realm of the black hole. You can join us on air or online with this conversation is always on. How do you picture a black hole? Can you picture anything of this scale? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Later this hour, we will remember Leonard Nimoy, Mr. Spock of Star Trek fame. But first, right now, into space for a minute. Before we go to black holes, a little closer to home, there's been a lot of spacewalking up there over the last week or so at the International Space Station. Tariq Malik is managing editor for Space.com, joins us now from New York City. Tariq, thanks for being here. What are they doing up there?
Hey, Tom, always a pleasure. Yes, the astronauts on the space station, NASA's Terry Virts and Barry Wilmore, basically spent the last week priming the space station for future private space taxis. And NASA wants to have those space taxis for American astronauts to fly to the station. To do that, these guys have served as glorified cable guys, routing some docking ports and preparing them for that work.
So this is so that we would, I mean, right now we're paying $70 million per seat to get our astronauts aboard Russia's Soyuz capsules to get up there.
Exactly, and then not just American astronauts, but also NASA's partners in Europe, Canada, and Japan. And it's a huge chunk of change. The price has gone up over the last 5 years by millions. And NASA last year has these new deals in place with Boeing, the new private company SpaceX, to replace that so that we can have our own U.S. access to space.
We all got focused on spacewalks when the Italian spacewalker was out there, Luca Parmitano, in 2013, and his helmet started filling with water. He almost drowned. We saw some of that going on this time, too. Why, Terry?
Yes. So when Luca Parmitano went out, he had something like 2 liters of water in his helmet. Very scary. You know, he couldn't see. He couldn't hear. What we saw over the last two spacewalks is NASA astronaut Terry Virts, after they came back inside the station, reported a minor leak, a small little leak. There was water on the inside of his spacesuit helmet. He could blow on it, and you could see ripples in that water. Nothing anywhere near as dangerous as what Luca Parmitano saw in 2013. And NASA says actually it's a leak related to the repressurization of the spacesuit itself, nothing that was going to be a danger outside the spacecraft.
Here's Terry Virts, flight engineer and spacewalker, talking with Mission Control from outside the International Space Station.
And Terry, just a heads up, you're just translating to the lab MMOD shield area.
Copy that. Thanks for the reminder.
Copy that. Just walking around in space. Was everything successful? Did they get it all done, these space cable guys?
They did. So it was a 3-spacewalk mission over the course of just over a week. Started on February 21st, and then last Wednesday, and then on Sunday. And they basically routed more than 700 feet of cable. It's a really tough and tricky job for these astronauts because of how stiff the fingers of their spacesuits. It's really hard on their hands. They also installed new antennas on the space station. And what's really key is these cables that they routed on these docking ports are going to be the kind of data highway for SpaceX's Dragon spacecraft or Boeing's CST-100, these new private American space taxis that will ferry NASA's astronauts back to the station.
We all saw, or many of us, in Gravity, the Oscar-winning movie from, a year or two ago now, George Clooney as the astronaut, drifting off into space. Have we ever come close to that happening?
Well, NASA did do it on purpose during the shuttle era with a what they called a mobility unit. It was like a backpack, a rocket backpack, that the astronaut Bruce McCandless tested out. Flew off way away from the shuttle. There's a stunning photo of him doing that in the movie. You see an astronaut kind of doing that, flying around the shuttle as well.
But it all melted down, and off he went in the movie. In reality,
they are very careful about their tethers. They have these things called tether swaps, where they're always connected to the space station, either through foot clamps on a robotic arm or through you know, actually just being hooked on. The space station is the length of a football field. They do have to swap these tethers out and be careful that they don't get tangled in them. But for the most part, they've always been, you know, very close and never free. They've lost tools before, Tom, but nothing, you know, so dangerous.
Well, we've heard there's a lot of junk up there, so maybe another wrench is okay. Still, football field long, that's a lot of spacewalking. Tarek Malik with space.com. It's always great to hear from you, Tarek. Thanks for joining us.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
Joining me now, two big experts on black holes. Priyamvada Natarajan is with me in the studio, professor of astronomy and physics at Yale. Her research focuses on supermassive black holes, galaxy formation, and mapping dark matter and energy. What are you doing these days? Priya Natarajan, welcome to On Point. Thank you very much for being here.
Thanks for inviting me. Delighted to be here.
And with us from Irvine, California, Fiona Harrison, professor of physics and astronomy at the California Institute of Technology, principal investigator at the New Star Telescope. That is a space-based X-ray telescope that surveys the universe for supermassive black holes. An author, she is, of the new study out in the journal Science that describes how wind from huge black holes regulates galaxy formation. Fiona Harrison, welcome to you. Thank you so much for being here.
Hi, Tom. My pleasure.
Priya, why are people excited about this black hole? There are a lot of black holes out there, so we found another one. So what?
Well, I guess what is incredible about this one is the gargantuan size of this one and how distant it is. So the mass of this black hole is about 12 billion times the mass of our sun. And it formed at cosmic dawn, practically 800 million years after the Big Bang. That is awfully soon for anything to form,
that's
let alone
6% of the time that's passed since the Big Bang. It's very early on.
Very early on, yeah.
Size is so great. But then it goes to mass. When it comes to black holes, I'm not sure if mass is the same as size. We think of size as volume, but there can be enormous mass in a very tiny space.
That's correct. So the thing about the black hole is not only the fact that it has intense gravity because of how the mass is arranged. It's very, very compact. So, for example, if our sun were to become a black hole, mm-hmm. to be compacted and have the intense gravity of a black hole, it would have the size of 3 kilometers. And if the Earth were to become a black hole, it would be the size of a chickpea. That's how concentrated all the mass in the Earth would have to become for the Earth to behave like a black hole.
So, Fiona, this one has 12 billion times the mass of the sun. That sounds incredibly big, but in terms of its actual dimensions, what do we know of them, Fiona?
Well, black holes literally are rips in the fabric of space-time, and so it's hard to think of a black hole having a size, but it does have an event horizon, which is a region from which even light can't escape. And that event horizon is pretty compact. You know, supermassive black holes have an event horizon to the size of the solar system. So this is how we define the size of a black hole.
So we get into really funky territory in a hurry. If Earth would be a black, it would be a chickpea, Priya. and this one, it's a rip in the fabric of space-time, which doesn't exactly sound like volume. How do you think about the size of it? When you say event horizon, you start going to start to lose a lot of lay listeners here. But how do you think about dimension? Yes, Priya.
So the event horizon is really the point of no return for a black hole. So it's sort of a proxy for its size. So it's mm-hmm. the region where the gravity is so intense that once you cross this line, even light cannot escape. So that's, and it's a measure, if you will, mm-hmm. of the kind of puncture that it would make in the fabric of space-time. You know, all mm-hmm. of space and time can be thought of a four-dimensional fabric, mm-hmm. and all mass causes little divots in the space-time. But the one that a black hole causes is a puncture. It's a very extreme pinch.
So light cannot escape. And yet, Fiona, I'm reading here Avi Loeb at the Harvard Astronomy Department talking about this black hole being the biggest monster we've ever detected in terms of luminosity, 40,000 times as bright as the entire Milky Way. That confused me, Fiona. Black hole sounds like no light. And here we're talking about luminosity, light.
Right. That is very confusing because black holes are black. As Priya already said, no light can escape from within the event horizon. But what you're seeing is stuff that's falling onto the black hole. Many black holes don't live in isolation. They live in galaxies where there's lots of dust and gas. And this dust and gas is attracted by the gravity of the black hole. And as it's attracted, it falls on and it arranges itself into a disk. And this disk of matter, in this disk, the matter spirals in onto the black hole. And after it plunges beyond that event horizon, you can't see it anymore. But before that, the gravity turns into heat through friction in this disk, and this disk glows brightly, and that's what we're seeing. We're seeing the intense light emitted by the stuff that's falling onto the black hole.
So is this kind of a halo around the black hole, Priya? Or, I mean, this is a quasar, technically, right? Is that correct?
That's correct. So you can think of it really as gas swirling onto the black hole and en route getting really heated to temperatures of 10 to the 8, like 100 million times degrees centigrade. And then it glows. And that's the glow that we are seeing of sort of the dying gasps of this gas that's falling onto the black hole. And we see the energy coming out mostly in the X-ray, but you see it sometimes in the optical, as for this particular quasar. And Fiona, of course, is the expert on studying the properties of the X-rays that emerge from this twirling gas as it makes its way in.
Oh, I find myself just enchanted by the kind of poetry of language around this. The ideas, the physics, I'm not sure I entirely get them, but we're going to dive on in and try. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Nothing escapes, not even light. Beyond the mystical horizon, we surrender to its might. Gazing into the
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking about black holes this hour. Kind of mania in the last week about this new supermassive black hole. We say new, only newly discovered. In fact, it's quite old, but that makes it a very early black hole, sort of a kid from the dawn of cosmic time, cosmic dawn, people are saying. A little of this talk in a popular film last year, Theory of Everything. Eddie Redmayne won a Best Actor Oscar for portraying Stephen Hawking in the film. Here's a clip where he, as Hawking is struggling with the disease, ALS, explains the idea of Hawking radiation to a group of scientists at Oxford.
Allowing us to predict that some particles can, in fact, escape a black hole. So black holes are not, in fact, black at all, but glow with heat radiation.
Eddie Redmayne depicting Stephen Hawking losing his capacity to speak there to ALS. Here, the actual Stephen Hawking, 2013, describing a breakthrough he made in understanding black holes.
I realized that I could apply to black holes the causal structure theory I had developed for singularity theorems. In particular, the area of the horizon, the boundary of the black hole, would always increase. When two black holes collide and merge, the area of the final black hole is greater than the sum of the areas of the original holes.
Stephen Hawking. Fiona Harrison of Caltech is with us from California today, very big in this field, and Priyamvada Natarajan of Yale with us as well. We've got big experts here. We're happy for your questions and calls. Titus in Atlanta, Georgia. Titus, you're on. Thank you for calling.
Thank you. It's a privilege to be on your show, Tom. I appreciate the opportunity.
Great to have
this
you.
Is one of my very favorite subjects, black holes. I'm a philosopher living in Atlanta. I'm an author of a book on metaphysics entitled Our Curious World of Mirror Images. And in that book, I present a completely original theory on the black hole. I developed the argument that the black hole is really the manifestation of the ending. The beginning and the ending, as mirror image poles, united as one, create space and time. And the black hole is the primordial, primitive architecture of the universe. It is the ending. And this is why, you know, around it, space and time is constricted. Things moving towards the black hole move from, you know, a plane to a line. And then it's cut off from the universe completely. And inside the hole, inside the event horizon, there is no more time, no more space. So the space-time exists outside between the beginning and the end, and the beginning, the alpha pole, is dark energy, which is this emission.
Titus, hang on right there. I want to take your philosophy to our physicists. You know, we have to listen carefully to what they say to figure out what it may mean in our everyday terms. Priya, you're listening to our philosopher in Atlanta. It's the beginning and the end, the alpha and omega. I don't know. Does that ring?
Well, I don't know about his particular version, but we do definitely know that black holes are the end states of stars. So when a star that's about 15 to 20 times the mass of the sun exhausts all the hydrogen in its core, and it then ends up as a black hole. So it's definitely the end state of a star. We know that. As for his theory of, you know, solving black holes, dark energy and everything, I'm not so sure.
Is it an analog for the end of everything, or this is just part of the process?
Well, given the fate of our universe as we have now come to understand it, of an accelerating, expanding universe, it is unlikely to end as a black hole.
Because it's headed the other way.
Right, yeah.
It's expanding. Fiona, what about what we can learn from this supermassive black hole and others about the early period of the universe's existence?
Well, one of the reasons this is so fascinating, as Priya already said, is that, very early in the universe, it was just a soup. It was a soup of particles. And today, we have planets and stars and black holes. And the question is, how did we get here? And so astronomers are always interested in looking at the most distant structures that we can see. And the discovery of these very distant, very large black holes tells us we went from this cosmic soup to, you know, huge black holes within a billion years. And how does that happen? How can we possibly form a black hole that big in such a short time? And this is one theorists are really going to have to puzzle with, because he either got us, you know, out of this primordial soup, you get gas clouds and those have to collapse into big black holes, or you make medium-sized black holes and they have to eat matter really, really, really fast to get this large. And so this is the fascinating thing about these distant black holes, is how did they form?
Priya, this early era and this particular black hole.
Yeah, I mean, I think theorists have been on the job. We've all been coming up with ideas, because this is a timing problem. Because so soon after the Big Bang, we have to assemble this monster. So one possibility, the traditional idea, is that you make the first star and then it leaves behind this little black hole that will eat gas very fast. And we now know of ways, one of my colleagues, Tal Alexander, and I wrote a paper last year where we said we can super boost the growth of this early black hole, even if it's a wimpy seed.
You can picture the circumstances in which that super growth would take place.
Yeah, physical conditions in the early universe with a lot of gas. Mm-hmm. Or alternatively, as we proposed about 10 years ago, that you can form these from the get-go to be much more massive than the end state of a star, which is a little wimpy.
So because they're chewing up gas clouds instead of single stars? Or
no, so this is what we call direct collapse black holes. So these are black holes that were formed in the very early gassy, gas-rich galaxies, perhaps even prior to the formation of the first star. Mm-hmm. So there are conditions where you could possibly bypass the formation of a star and go straight to it, funnel all the gas right into the center very, very rapidly, and possibly form such a black hole.
Eric in Bowling Green, Kentucky. Eric, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Thanks, Tom. My question is simple. What do you think is happening on the other side? Thanks.
Dive into a black hole and what's going on? I mean, a lot is being sucked in here, and you're calling it, Fiona, a rip in the in the fabric of space and time. So help our caller picture, in whatever terms you like, what's in there, or is there nothing in there, or is nothing not the right kind of word to use?
Well, you know, actually, that's a really good question, because there is still some debate about what happens inside what we had called the event horizon of the black hole. And maybe you saw the movie Gravity.
Yes, yes.
There's some conjecture. But you know, I think there's still a matter of theoretical debate there among people who study general relativity.
So what would the terms of the debate be? I mean, you know, do you get into metaphysics at that point, or is there a physics projection you can do about what's going on in there, Priya?
So, you know, one of the speculations that was beautifully animated in this recent movie, Interstellar, mm-hmm. Tells you that possibly, you know, the inside of a black hole could lead you, would be a portal, would be a wormhole that could possibly lead you outside our universe. So, of course, you know, these
are
not
you just telling us this because this is a story we can relate to, or is it all more mathematical than that in the main in your mind? Or
well, I mean, it's mathematical in the sense that you can actually tunnel away from our universe. But where you end up and what that really means, nobody really understands. And as Fiona just said, it's a matter of much debate, even what happens right inside the horizon. Even that, as you may remember, last year, there was this debate about fuzz or fire, so a fireball, whether the matter that goes right in once it crosses the event horizon, what really becomes of it. So these are pretty thorny questions that theorists are still debating and are unsettled.
Is there a limit to how much a black hole can gobble up? Is there a point at which it's as big as they get? I've heard of something called obese black holes, which I don't even know what that means.
Right. So actually, it was an idea that we put out a few years ago. I mean, we believe because of the interplay between star formation and the growth of a galaxy and the black hole that it harbors in the center, that there is probably some kind of self-regulation. So black holes likely stunt their own growth eventually. One can imagine, obviously, if they have gobbled up all the gas that there is and they've depleted the entire gas reservoir, obviously, they're going to stop growing. But beside that, there might be, we believe, some kind of synchronicity because, you know, the same gas that has to funnel into the black hole also forms stars. So you might reach an equilibrium where you can no longer funnel the gas in and it actually cools fragments and forms stars before it actually makes its way in.
Fiona, every or most galaxies have a black hole at their core, at their center. Why is that, Fiona?
Actually, I can't tell you why. It was a bit of a surprise over the last 20, 25 years when we realized that this is the case. Every galaxy like the Milky Way,
ours,
galaxy, mm-hmm. has a supermassive black hole at the center. And what was even more astonishing to astronomers who study the galaxies and black holes is that there's a relationship between the mass of the black hole and the mass of the galaxy. So why is that astonishing? Well, black holes, you know, they have a lot of mass, but not so much compared to all the stars in the galaxy. So their gravity only influences a very small fraction of the galaxy. And so what makes this connection? Well, we think it came about through the evolution over time, where the growing of black holes by matter falling on has an influence on the galaxy, mm-hmm. can actually put energy out into the galaxy and affect the formation of stars, even blow dust and gas away. And so there is not only are black holes not rare, they're very common, but they also have an influence on the growth of galaxies.
Let me ask you this, Priya. So the Milky Way has a supermassive black hole. Do we know where it is?
Yeah, of course.
You can map it.
We know where it is, and the location is marked by the star Sagittarius A.
Okay, so we can look up, and if the circumstances are right, nice up in the mountains or somewhere nice and dark, you can see the Milky Way. We are somewhere in the Milky Way. Are we in the neighborhood of the black hole? Are we at the far end of the galaxy from the black hole? Are we close or far within our galaxy?
We're very far away. I mean, the center of the Milky Way is 100,000 light years away from us. So that's how long it takes light to travel from there. You know, in contrast to the sun, from where the light takes mm-hmm. only 8 minutes, right?
So if you were over nearer to our black hole, is it gobbling up the...
It is. So the black hole at the center of our galaxy, the center of our galaxy is very gas poor at the moment. So there are few...
Not much fuel or
no,
to eat
it's
then.
Kind of, it's a dead black hole.
Okay.
So it's actually not like the one that was discovered right now. So mm-hmm. there are active black holes, which are quasars, mm-hmm. and then there are these dead black holes, which is what we find littered around our neighborhood in the nearby galaxies, including our own. So what you see in the Milky Way, which is intriguing, is the effect of the gravity on the stars that are really right in the vicinity. We can see mm-hmm. the gravity of the black hole affecting the motions of the stars. stars. They've actually been measured because, you know, we're close enough and we can resolve it. Mm-hmm. In fact, one of our colleagues, Andrea Ghez at UCLA, has intriguing movies where you can see the orbits of the stars that are actually kind of yanked back towards the black hole. They miss it, of course, but they're there and, you know, they've been mapped. So that's actually how we also know how massive this black hole is.
Fiona, how was this new one found?
This very distant large one, yeah. So it was found in the optical. If you survey the sky, you find lots of optical objects. Some mm-hmm. are stars, some are galaxies, and some are these black holes, where the light from the black hole is outshining the galaxy the black hole lives in. And you can, you know, you have to filter through a huge amount of data because there are, you know, billions of sources of optical light out there. Mm-hmm. And so what astronomers do is they break the light up into colors and they examine the colors of the light. And that enables them to say, this is a star, this is a galaxy, or this is a really bright black hole.
Now, if it weren't surrounded by superheated gas, by a quasar, could you still spot it optically, or that's the only way?
Well, you know, if you were outside our galaxy and you looked at it, you would really only see the stars because, as Priya said, we have a dead black hole. And so it wouldn't be possible to detect it unless you could really zoom in and look at the motions of individual stars. So by and large, you know, many nearby galaxies have these black holes, but they're not shining. They're not outshining the starlight. These powerful quasars are eating matter so fast that that matter is heating up to very high temperatures. You get regions where particles are accelerated close to the speed of light. And all of this bright energy coming off enables us to say that there is a black hole. And that was one of the first things when quasars were discovered. There was a big debate about whether they could be distant objects because they were so powerful. And astronomers, when they realized they were distant, the clue that there were black holes there were that really it's only the strong gravity of a black hole that can power that intense emission.
Is it your new star telescope up in space, Fiona, that's involved in having found this or not?
No. What New Star does is it, instead of looking in the optical, mm-hmm. it looks in the X-rays. X-rays, the same energy X-rays, the same kind of X-rays that your doctor or dentist would use. Mm-hmm. New Star examines the universe in that kind of X-ray. And what we're looking for is not in this black hole, but in many black holes, you get powerful X-ray emission. And that's what New Star sees.
Fiona Harrison, please stand by at Caltech. It's great to have you here. And Priya Natarajan of Yale with me in the studio. We're bringing you a selection of black hole music in this hour. This is Rush with Cygnus X1 from 1977. I'm sure it's on your playlist. We'll be right back. Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at wbur.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about black holes, supermassive black hole, newly discovered, the announcement made last week from very, very early in the life of the universe. We're looking at that supermassive black hole and new insights on the cosmic dawn, those that early period of our universe itself. Fiona Harrison is with us from Caltech, professor of physics and astronomy there, and Priyamvara Natarajan, professor of astronomy and physics at Yale University. Here's a question from one of our listeners, Diamond Dave. Wonders if our Big Bang was the result of a black hole from another universe. Is a new universe at the end of every black hole? Priya.
Well, I think it's a speculation. I don't think we have a scientific theory that could either support or...
But you were talking about wormholes that could be behind the rip in the time space-time fabric here. A wormhole goes somewhere or not.
Yeah, potentially to another universe. I mean, it depends on whether you actually believe, the operative word is believe, mm-hmm. whether there are other universes out there. I happen to believe that we're part of a multiverse, that there are many, many universes out there, and we just happen to be inhabiting one of them.
That's a scientific hunch or a metaphysical religious hunch?
I think it's a speculation that is comfortable scientifically and philosophically is what I would say.
It sounds like the Supreme Court talking about penumbras of meaning. Edward in Montreal. Edward, you're on the air.
I heard about a book by Lawrence Krauss called Our Miserable Future, in which he talks about the fact that all the galaxies are moving away from each other, and eventually they'll just be what he called the heat death of the universe. And that, I found that very disheartening. And then I heard about the theories of Lee Smolin at the Perimeter Institute in Waterloo, Ontario. And he spoke of that very idea that when you look at our universe and how fine-tuned it is, there's a number of constants that don't have to be the way they are, but the fact that they are the way they are supports the generation of stars and mm-hmm. life on planets. So he says that his speculation or theory about why that is because black holes retain the properties of their parent universes and generate child universes that convey the properties of the parent universe through the black hole. So I was wondering, given that this idea comes from Lees, that the director mm-hmm. of the Perimeter Institute must have more, be beyond just speculation and have sound grounding in mathematics and physics. And I was hoping to get your response to that.
Edward, let us pick it up. Fiona, how about you on this universe generation through black holes, the child universe behind the black hole and so on? What's your response?
Well, I think Priya put it pretty well. It is a matter of speculation. It's not contradicted by any known physical laws, but at some point, again, these things become a matter of speculation.
Mm-hmm. Well, that makes it sound like physics experts are in the same boat as anybody looking up from their backyard, but I know you're not, Priya.
No, so I mean, I think the reason this is speculation and it's sort of beyond the realm, mm-hmm. Because it's beyond the realm where we can actually get any kind of evidence.
Mm-hmm.
And observational evidence. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it sort of subverts this whole idea of the scientific method where, you know, we have hypotheses and we need the data. Mm-hmm. So by definition, we can never really get any information from beyond the Big Bang, before the Big Bang. So any...
We're talking about going, what's in a black hole, then you bring up going beyond the Big Bang. What's the connection between those two?
No, it's the last caller was uh-huh. suggesting that these child universes get spawned by black holes and so on and
yes.
so forth.
So as ours might have been spawned in such a way, or they're being, I realize this is wholly speculative here.
So I think the reason why these theories are speculative is that we cannot obtain empirical evidence to support in the same way that we have, for example, for the discovery of this quasar.
Our Montreal caller said he was disheartened by the notion of this endlessly expanding universe, meaning essentially everything is getting farther and farther away from us, that over time it's not going to be one big Star Trek convention with, you know, bumping into everybody, but we'll be more and more alone. The distances between everything will become bigger and bigger. I found that pretty disheartening as well. Is that just my social sentiments as a puny creature on a tiny planet, meaningless middle of nowhere?
No, not at all. I think it is sad that it is a desolate universe, and we just have to come to terms with it.
And Fiona, what about this? Many of our listeners are saying, what am I supposed to do with the idea of a black hole? It's so vast, so far, it just, it's an imposing idea. It's an intellectual puzzle and stimulation, but how do you relate to it?
Well, you know, it's sort of interesting. When I first started studying the theory called general relativity that gives mm-hmm. rise to black holes, it just seemed so unintuitive to me. And eventually, you know, you sort of begin to understand the mathematics, and then you just start to believe. And becoming an astronomer, you know, you don't have to take it on faith. We find these black holes. I mean, it's kind of amazing that what started out as a pure thought experiment mm-hmm. by Einstein, you know, of a very strange behavior of space and time being ripped, creating a black hole, is now that is something, unlike what happened before the Big Bang, that is something that's on observationally very firm grounds. They exist. We know this. We know from watching the stars in our own galaxy that the only possibility is that there's a black hole at its very center.
Is there a question, Priya, in the study of black holes that everyone knows is out there? If we can just figure out this question, we'll learn X, Y, or Z great insight about the whole universe. Is there something that everyone's trying to unlock about the black hole that would explain origins or where we're headed or how it all interacts?
I think I want to reiterate something that Fiona mentioned earlier, right? So one of the intriguing things about black holes are, you know, they're these sort of very enigmatic objects with very peculiar properties, but they have real important impact on the formation of all structure in the universe, now we have come to learn. So they modulate the formation of stars and galaxies, quench them sometimes. And so I think those sort of questions, that really big open questions, are, of course, how the first ones came to be, mm-hmm. how big the first ones were, and how they were generated. And as always, we now think that nature probably has many different channels for doing so, maybe the first stars, maybe these direct collapse. But then also the idea of how they grow in tandem with galaxies. So while we may not learn anything about the actual origins of the universe per se, we are going to learn a lot about the origin of structure. So the correlation and properties between the galaxies that host these black holes and the properties of the black holes are intriguing. We really want to know whether these correlations were set up very early in the universe. Are they a consequence of late time merging, sort of violent merging of galaxies? So I think those are sort of the big open astrophysical questions.
They make us appear so tiny, so minute. I think it's quite marvelous that even from our tiny little speck spot as spectators of the universe, we are figuring some things out here. It's really wonderful. Priyamvara Natarajan of Yale, thank you so much for coming in. So glad you were here and be able to be with us in the studio today. Thank you very much, Priya.
Thank you so much. It's particularly special because it's 100 years after Einstein proposed the theory of general relativity, 1915.
Here we are. Perfect, perfect. On this year, Fiona Harrison at Caltech joining us from Irvine, California. Thank you so much for your black hole insights today, Fiona.
My pleasure.
Wonderful to have you. In a moment, remembering Leonard Nimoy, this is On Point. Actor Leonard Nimoy, Star Trek's Spock, died last week at age 83. It left many of his fans struggling, Vulcan-like, to control their emotions. Joining me now from San Francisco is Charlie Jane Anders, co-editor of the science fiction blog IO9. She wrote an appreciation of Leonard Nimoy and Spock titled Leonard Nimoy Showed Us What It Truly Means to Be Human. You can link to it from our website, onpointradio.org. Charlie Jane Anders, welcome to On Point. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Tom.
Hold the phone right there for just a second. Here's Leonard Nimoy, as you might not know him, tried his hand at music over time, some albums in the 1960s. Here's Leonard Nimoy singing Highly Illogical, in which Nimoy, as Spock, is bewildered by human behavior.
Girl meets boy. They fall in love. She says he's everything.
she's dreamed of. But when they get married, before he's aware, she changes his habits, the way he combs his hair. She changes him to someone he's never been, and then complains he's not like other men. Now really, I find this most illogical.
Charlie Jane, is that what it means to be truly human right there? We're all boogieing here in the control room and studio. But.
That song is a classic, and it's part of what we all loved about Leonard Nimoy, which is that he could laugh at himself and at this role that made him famous. Even though he was worried about being typecast, he also was always happy to make fun of it and kind of joke about it. And, you know, a lot of people took Spock very seriously because Spock and Leonard Nimoy meant a lot to a lot of people.
But why do you say he shows us what it truly means to be human? He was, after all, a Vulcan. He was supposed to be other than human, different.
Well, I mean, what I think is so brilliant about Leonard Nimoy's portrayal of Spock is both that he sort of illuminates the nature of humanity through the half-human, half-Vulcan character, and also that he shows us something of ourselves in the other, in this alien character whose main function is to be non-human, but who ends up, as William Shatner, as Kirk says in Wrath of Khan, Spock is the most human in the end of all the souls.
Here you had Shatner as Captain Kirk, of course. You had McCoy, and you had Sulu, and you had Scott, and you had Uhura, and all the rest, Chekhov. Why do you think there was so much sentiment for the one who was supposed to be sort of the least human, who was partly alien?
I think it's partly because, you know, Leonard Nimoy made it cool to be smart again, or he made it cool to be smart on television, and he made it sexy to be smart. I mean, while he was still on TV, and Isaac Asimov wrote this famous essay about how Mr. Spock is dreamy and about how the teenage girls only want Mr. Spock. And he also brought just so many layers and so much depth to this character. And there is sort of this formula on Star Trek where, you know, Captain Kirk, who's sort of the emotional focal point a lot of the time, is freaking out about things. He's constantly just emoting at the screen about whatever crisis they're dealing with. And then there's this kind of still point next to him. And you just want to look into that still point and see what's really going on there. And Leonard Nimoy, if you do look into what he's doing, there's a lot going on, like every moment he's on screen.
Here's one of those moments from the original Star Trek series. Impact hits the Enterprise shaken. Lieutenant Uhura, played by Nichelle Nichols, looks to Spock for an explanation.
Mr. Spock, are you all right?
Yes, I believe no permanent damage was done.
What happened?
The occipital area of my head seems to have impacted with the arm of the chair.
No, Mr. Spock, I meant, what happened to us?
That we have yet to ascertain.
The cerebral, unflappable, pointy-eared Vulcan, as the Times called him, with the signature salute and blessing, live long and prosper. Something's gone on with my head, but I have no idea what it is, and yet people could not get enough of it.
Yeah, it's that dry humor. It's that sort of, you know, that detached sensibility. And he could have, I mean, he gets a lot of laughs out of that performance, but he doesn't just play it for laughs. He plays it, you know, you get the sense that he's laughing with us and that he's in on the joke.
Grew up in Boston, did a lot of other things before he made it. Soda jerk and movie usher and cab driver in California when he was studying acting. And then here comes this role. It's only 3 years the original show was on the air. He was kind of stuck in that character for life. I mean, he did other things, played Tevye in Fiddler on the Roof and more. But he wrote these two autobiographies, I Am Not Spock and I Am Spock. So what did he think about the way this role encased him in the end?
I think he was terribly worried about being typecast. I mean, right after he left Star Trek, he took this role on Mission Impossible as a master of disguise, partly so that he could be playing a different character every week on a show that lots of people were watching. And it didn't work because Star Trek started becoming huge in syndication in the early 70s after Mission Impossible was over. And I think he was frustrated with people thinking that he was Spock and coming up to him for answers. And he had a stock response when people would come up to me and be like, oh, all this meaningful stuff and, oh, what really happened to the Enterprise in this episode? He would just say, I'm an actor. I play a character. And I think that he felt as though he was a little bit stuck in that role, and he came to embrace it over time. And I think that was why there was that motion between I Am Not Spock, trying to kind of correct people's misperceptions, to I Am Spock. This is recognizing that he was a huge part of the character and the character was a huge part of him.
Here's that famous 1982 scene, Wrath of Khan. Spock sacrifices himself to save the Enterprise, says this heartrending farewell to Captain Kirk as he succumbs to radiation.
I have been, and always shall be, your friend. Live long. Prosper.
And there he went. Of course, years later, last week, actually, Leonard Nimoy. Charlie Jane Andrews, what will you miss about the Nimoy as an actor and the Spock character?
I mean, I will miss that sort of detached humor, but also there's those glimpses of soulfulness. And that clip you just played, I got goosebumps listening to it. I mean, that affected me deeply when I first saw that movie. I still, you know, get this almost a physical feeling of sadness and grief when I think about that scene and how he played it. I will miss his warmth and his humor in life. I mean, anybody who ever met him or interacted with him knew that he was this very warm, giving person who spent, you know, even after he quit acting, spent his life, you know, photographing people who other people might not want to photograph and kind of exposing the beauty in people around him. He was a very generous soul.
Leonard Nimoy, gone at 83, but what a character he played. Charlie Jane Anders at IO9, thank you so much for joining us from San Francisco today.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point with the Wrath of Khan theme.